What's up, Gator Nation?
Good morning, Gator Nation.
You're listening to Gator Nation.
And the Gators have the biggest lead of the day.
You're listening to Morning Edition on WUMT.
From the University of Florida's College of Journalism and Communication.
3, 2, 1, we're live.
Hi, everyone. This is The Communicator, the University of Florida College of Journalism and Communications podcast, where we dive into the latest in media, picking the brains of top faculty and staff around the Gator Nation. I'm Matt Abramson, Director of Media Services with Riley Fowler.
Hello.
And Patrice Quatton.
Greetings.
Today, we're speaking with Maya Hutchins, Associate Professor and Chair in the Department of Public Relations. Thanks for joining us, Maya.
Glad to be here.
So what initially inspired you to get into public relations and the communication field?
So I didn't really know what to do in college. I'm first gen, so didn't have a whole lot of ideas about what jobs were. I was good at math and science in school, but it was boring to me because once you figured out the equation, you just did the same thing over and over and over. So I knew I wanted to do something with people that were different. And they're like, oh, well, you're an extrovert. You should do public relations. It'll be fun. So then did that, started working for my college paper, and found that I loved hearing people talking about what I wrote, like walking around campus and this idea that I was creating what people knew. And you do that even more in PR, right? So, you know, the journalists are writing it, but a lot of time I got my tip from a PR person. So got more into that, this idea of media relations and wanted to take that track.
So you earn your bachelor's and master's degrees from Washington State University, followed by your PhD in communications from The Ohio State University. You have to accent the
The is important.
How was navigating each of these different schools, and what was your focus of your doctoral research in particular?
Yeah, so Washington State is, I've always been at a large state institution everywhere that I've been. But so WSU, Pullman, Washington is a very unique place if you've never been there. It's 30,000 people, and that includes the 20,000 students. So it is a college town. Like, it exists because of the college. But so that was really fun. I figured out I wanted to be a researcher towards the end of my undergrad, took our campaigns class, which was the capstone for PR, and we had to do a research project that was social science research for the campaign. And I was like, wait, I can apply math and science to people? That's a job? And so I talked to my professor. I was like, how do I get a job just doing this? And she's like, well, that's what professors do. And I was like, I had no idea. So stayed there for my master's, just working on actually health communication research, working for the Washington State Department of Health, working on anti-tobacco campaigns. So this idea of trying to understand how to encourage people to do good things. But I didn't actually really love the health stuff. What I did love, though, was politics, which was why I then went to Ohio State. So I went to Ohio State very purposefully to work with the professor that I worked with there, Chip Evelyn, William P. Evelyn Jr. And so Ohio State was very different from Washington State in that it was still a big state school, but it's huge, right? It's about the size of Florida. We're about the same size, so 60,000 when you include the undergrad and the grad. And it's in Columbus, Ohio, which is actually bigger than you think it is. It's almost 2 million people. And so that was just a very different environment, right? So Ohio State was different. I thought I knew about football. The Apple Cup is very important to me. It's still a very culturally relevant event for me. Ohio State, Michigan, y'all, that's different.
But hey, we have Urban Meyer.
We have that in common. So when I came to Florida, like my office hoodie, because I'm usually cold, was an Ohio State hoodie, and people were glaring at me here. And so I was like, I don't understand. Like, we're in different conferences.
That's normal behavior.
Yeah. And so then I was told, no, Urban Meyer left us and went to Ohio State. And I was like, oh, okay, I understand.
He claimed a heart issue, I think, or a medical issue.
For a year took Ohio State. And then, you know, we won a championship. And then he also destroyed our locker room, just like he destroyed the locker room here. So, you know. We have that in common. So I learned that there's a weird, even though Big Ten, SEC, I no longer have the Ohio State hoodie in my office.
That's a great move. Great move.
Yeah, I learned.
So where did your research take you in your PhD program?
So I was looking, I started off looking at kids primarily. So sort of the idea of how do people learn about politics as you're first sort of developing. Doing research with kids is super hard. It's just like, it's sort of a pain. You have to get all of these extra levels of permissions. And I'm like, that's interesting and important. And I think it's good and things people need to know. But I don't know if that's the thing that I necessarily need to know about. So what I started studying more was this idea of how can we do politics better, right? So I very much believe in the idea that arguing is good if you do it the correct way, right? Like, that's how you learn new information. If you're just talking to people that already think what you think, like, that's not helpful. So I spent a lot of time trying to understand what does our discussion networks look like. So sort of the all of the people that we talk to, what's sort of that composition and how does that influence what we know about politics and how we behave in politics and what's sort of the better mix of that to happen. And so that was what I spent 4 years doing primarily, and it's still a key piece of what I still do now, you know, 20 years later.
And you were publishing research as a PhD student at the time?
Yep.
Fantastic.
You don't get a job as a professor if you don't publish as a PhD student, or you don't get a job as a professor at a place like where I wanted to be, a big state institution that was a research one. So,
Hi, this is Riley again. You said your initial research was in health before moving into more politics. Was there any particular project or research subject that like either spurred your interest in politics or confirmed that this was like the correct direction your research should be going in?
So a lot of it was really thinking about what I cared about. So I think most people know you're not supposed to smoke cigarettes. Most people know you're supposed to wear your seatbelt, right? And so sort of the research that I was doing was trying to encourage people to do what we would call pro-social behaviors or doing things that are good for you. Everyone knows the health stuff. If you're not doing it, it's because you think something else is more important to you. You are addicted to the nicotine. You really like how it feels when you're binge drinking, right? There's something about that that you know why. Politics, I think people don't know, right? There's a whole lot of people that think that politics don't influence their everyday life. It's not something that's important to them, so they sort of ignore it. I grew up in a household where news was talked about, right? We got the local paper. It was on the kitchen table, right? That I grew up reading it and seeing that happening. And I was like, this is the behavior that I think people actually don't know about and I want to encourage, right? So it's like, health stuff, yes, I can do it and I can try to figure out how to make a better message, but people know. But I can apply that same sort of idea of how do I persuade people to do good things, but do it in a political context. And I don't do a lot of persuasive political comm research anymore. Now it's more like, here's the craziness that we exist. Can I understand it and figure out how we might tweak it one way or another to make it better? But it's work that I think matters and I think the average person doesn't think about.
So you mentioned wanting to get into research and possibly even teaching. So you were an assistant professor at Texas Tech University, followed by University of Arizona. What spurred you to stay in academia from the student that didn't really want to leave campus?
Right? At the end of the day, my job as a professor is to be curious about something and find an answer. I cannot imagine a cooler job than that. Right? There's a lot of other things, especially now as chair, that are not that I have to do. But the end of the day, right? I just think that is the coolest job. I love teaching. I don't love grading. Anyone who says they love grading is super lying. But I love sort of seeing that aha moment, being able to share stuff. So that's great. But if you told me tomorrow that I wouldn't teach again ever, I'd be like a little sad, but that wouldn't be a deal breaker for me. If you told me tomorrow I would never get to do another research project again, I'd quit, right? I'd find something else. Like, that is why I got a PhD. That's why I've always worked at a research institution. That idea of I get to decide what I think is cool and interesting, and the world needs to know, right? Like, going back to why I was excited as a journalist, like hearing people talk about what I was doing, that I was contributing to what people knew, like that's really what I do as a researcher. Like, I am contributing to what we know, and I get to decide what's cool about that. You can go work in industry and do research, but you're doing what your boss tells you to, right? You're doing research to benefit an organization, benefit, you know, the bottom line. Whereas a researcher, especially the type of researcher that I am, I'm doing research to improve democracy, which is something that I think is really important. Right? And critical and fun, right? I really think I have the best job ever.
I mean, you notice phenomena, that especially stuff that might, you know, show up on your antennas and you're like, oh, what's this? And then you just dive into research and try to make sense of it.
Right.
That's phenomenal.
Again, coolest job ever.
In 2014, you then worked as assistant professor of political communications at Washington State University. Did that feel like a full circle moment returning back to your alma mater? And did this role focus exclusively on political comms?
Yes and no. So, it was very cool to go back to WSU. So, again, I grew up in Washington State. I love the mountains. Florida is very pretty. However, Pacific Northwest is really the prettiest part of the United States.
Which one's rainier, though?
Not my side. Yeah. Actually, it rains way more in Florida. So, Eastern Washington, there's a giant mountain range that divides the state. West of it, so Seattle, rains a ton. You see the sun only in July and August. Other side of the state, think Montana more than Seattle. Four real seasons, not that rainy, actually technically high desert. So way more rain here. But so really pretty. My husband's also a professor, which accounts for some of the moving around, right? So Texas Tech was my first job while he was finishing his PhD and then did a postdoc. We were able to get hired together at Arizona, thought we'd stay there forever. And then WSU recruited us. So at that point, you know, we're sort of a known couple.
Power couple in the academic
research
circles.
Power couple.
Yeah.
Team Hutchlowski. Because we do not share the same name. So that's our combo name. But so when they recruited us, I'm like, this is awesome. I absolutely want to go back to the Pacific Northwest. It's beautiful. You know, Tucson was cool. A very cool place. If you've not visited, visit it. But so it was great to be back there. The issue is they have some budget difficulties. And so while we were there, stayed there, got tenure, and then it was like, I see the writing on the wall. And so friends that are still there, we definitely made the correct decision to leave. But so while I was there, I've been in a bunch of different departments. I've worked in a public relations department. I was in the School of Journalism at Arizona. At Washington State, I was in Communication and Society was the name of the unit. And so it was where the political stuff lived, where the environmental and science stuff, like all of that was in that department. And so I taught PolCom was the primary thing that I taught, and research methods, which I have taught research methods since I'm a grad student. I love teaching that class. That's like the best light bulb moment class for people, when I convince them this is a skill that you need to know and you are going to be better because you know how to do this. And then they figure it out and they're like, "Whoa, yes, I know what people are going to do now because of science." It's fun. Again, you clearly sense my level of geekness on this area.
So in 2018, you flipped coasts.
Yes.
You descended on the Swamp, joining UFCJC as assistant professor. What excited you most about coming to Gainesville and the opportunities that were here?
So Jay had to convince me to apply to University of Florida.
Was he applying at the same time?
Yeah.
Okay.
So that was when we were tenured professors at Washington State, but saw the budget crash that was coming and just a lot of other things, which we realized WSU was not the university that we wanted to finish our careers at. So because of who we are as people, we made a giant spreadsheet of universities that we would apply to.
It was color-coded, I'm sure.
It was. Universities that we would apply to based on a bunch of different criteria, cost of living, what their library resources were. That was a huge sticking point for me that I had to like email friends to get journal articles, but a whole bunch of different things. And so Jay wanted to put Florida on the list. And I'm like, why do you know where Florida is? Like, that's very far away. It's very hot. I don't like humidity. And he's like, no, trust me. Just put it on the list. I think you'll like it. He was right, right? So then a job came open. I applied, fell in love down here. Just the Florida attitude is 100% what I'm about. This idea of we're going to be good and watch us. Because every place says they want to be good. Most places don't want to actually do the work to do that. And everyone that I interacted with, all of the faculty, the students that I would talk to, you all like need to know, students in the room, you are the reason why people come here. You are so fun to teach. Like, again, I've always been at a large state school. I will take a University of Florida student any day of the week over anywhere I've been. But so just that Florida attitude was something that I really liked. And I'm like, this is what I want.
I thought it was the humidity that you were going for. Oh, dude.
I whine less every year, right? I'm getting slightly better. It's still rough. And I just have to, in February, I was out at First Mag after the Springs run in February, just sitting there. And I was like, oh, I need to remember this in September when I'm really, really angry. I need to remember this moment.
Yeah, so when everyone's complaining about how cold it is for 2 months, I'm like, you're...
I know. Soak it in. You forget September when it's already been really hot for a long time and it's still going to be hot for another long time.
When you walk from the parking lot to the building and you're drenched in sweat in the morning. Gosh.
This is Patrice. You spoke a little bit about some of the research that you've done and why you wanted to do that research. And most of your research focuses on misinformation, polarization, and media echo chambers. What have been some of the most surprising discoveries that you have seen and that you have discovered?
Yeah. So I am very proud of the fact that my co-authors and I were one of the first scholars to say that social media was not detrimental to democracy. Okay. That social media could actually be helpful, which everyone now agrees with us. But when we were doing this, it was people were like, what are you talking about? And how we were able to find that was we did data collection over time. So we followed the same people throughout an entire election campaign. So at three different time points and did this on a couple of different time points, looking at how much they're using social media, how polarized they are, and then how much they're exposed to people who either think like them or not like them. And so we found, contrary to what was sort of the common knowledge at that point, which was like, if you're on social media, it's going to make you more polarized. Everything is evil, right? But what we found actually is the more time you spend on social media, the more interaction you had with people who were not like you, because you aren't muting everyone that you disagree with on social media. You cannot create a perfect echo chamber. So instead, what happens is people who are on social media actually ended up being less polarized at the end of the campaign. What is happening, what is actually driving polarization, is broadcast TV use, which really ended up being cable TV use. So the more you spend in the rage machine, unexpectedly, right, is going to increase your polarization. And also the more time you spend talking to people who are like yourself, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're thinking about it, if you're talking to people who think like you, you usually aren't debating the finer points of policy, right? You're talking about how horrible the other side is. And so even though social media was the new thing, right? And so we're seeing polarization increase. And so obviously it's social media because social media is the new thing, but it wasn't. It was that how we were talking was changing. And social media actually was the way to counter that a little bit. And so I'm still very proud that we were some of the first people to actually be doing that work, to be like, no, right? It doesn't matter where the information's coming from, whether it's mediated, whether it's interpersonal, it's what does it look like? And social media can actually be good for it. So,
yeah.
Has that insight changed over the past 10 years as Twitter turns into X.
Yes.
And TikTok is now with us.
And so this is the weirdness. And so I'm collecting data actually right now. I'm doing a panel right now that's incorporating sort of the newer social media information. And so come back in 4 months and I might have a different answer for you or what it looks like now. Because so 2012, 2016, 2020, that was the data that I had for that. And so consistently across those three election cycles, we saw the same thing. The social media in 2025 now looks vastly different than it was in 2020. In 2020, everybody was still on Facebook. That was still the dominant platform where everybody was. At that point, Twitter was still Twitter, not X. And so that was where elites and journalists were. So it was this playground of craziness, right? And it's also who you follow and that sort of thing. But it's still that was the single point. What we are seeing now with social media is increasing fragmentation. So what's happening to social media is what happened to cable news, right? So cable news used to be we were all watching the same things. You would have different opinions about it, but we all got the same facts. Then it fragmented. And now you can go find your particular flavor of facts in cable news. Social media is now becoming that. So it's not, oh, everybody's there and you're going to bump into mostly people who are like you based on who you're following, but you're going to get some disagreeable. Now, if you just want a liberal viewpoint, you can go to Blue Sky. If you just want a conservative viewpoint, you can go to Rumble or True Social, right? Like pick your flavor. And so I do think that that's something that's going to change. But this is also why I love communication and why I love being a communication professor, because I will never have the same day twice. We will always communicate, but we will always do it different. Mm-hmm. And so we have to keep learning and trying to understand what's happening. And social media is very much a different place right now.
Yeah, it's not static. It's changing regularly.
I'm Glenn Richards from WUFT Amplified. If you're like me, you appreciate how special the local music scene is here in North Central Florida, featuring indie rock, hip-hop, bluegrass, and so much more. WUFT Amplified is Florida's music series, filmed right here in Weimer Hall. This show rocks, guys, seriously. And you might not realize that WUFT Amplified is produced entirely by UFCJC staff and students. To watch past episodes and discover your new favorite bands, check out WUFT.org/amplified.
Like you just touched on, much of your research also focuses on presidential elections and communication behaviors. What insights have you uncovered about these phenomena?
The biggest thing when we're thinking about elections is that there's points in time that matter, right? That's when people start paying attention. And so thinking about it, how can you sort of capitalize on those time points of attention, right? But also because communication constantly changes and things constantly change, this election was weird, right? Each election is weird in its own ways. 2024, I think, was extra weird. A, because we first had two candidates that were both incumbents, essentially, right? Which is unusual. And then we lost a candidate in the middle of a campaign and got a new one. And so some of these time points that we normally think about driving the election cycle, that, you know, people don't start paying attention until Labor Day, and then the conventions are turning points and the debates are turning points. Well, we don't have the debate commission anymore, or we didn't use it this past year. So what are debates going to look like in the next presidential cycle? I think potentially 2028 is going to break sort of a lot of what we know about elections, just because it's constantly evolving and our communication environment constantly evolves.
Yeah, how much are podcasts going to play a role in the next one?
Huge, huge. I 100%. So in the data that I'm collecting right now is looking specifically at podcasts. Podcasts were starting to make an impact on this last one. That's where people are moving, right? And so I think in the next one, you guys, you're on the ground floor. Be the change, right?
All right, you heard that first, candidates, come do our show. So how extensively has media trust eroded? I know that's one of the topics that you're interested in as well. And what factors continue to be most impactful in that?
Right. Media trust has cratered. We are at a new all-time low right now. And the biggest factor for that is partisanship, right? People don't trust media. They don't trust them to give an unbiased view. So what they trust is what's telling them what they already believe, right? And so that's sort of a big hurdle to try to overcome, right? And so I've done different work trying to look at, are there different ways that we can present the information to sort of increase trust in media, increase sort of faith in the information that we're getting? I'm just getting ready right now to run an experiment that's manipulating how we're talking about partisans in the story. So are in news coverage, do we make sure that we're referring to both parties and how they're similar on topics? Because this is like the elephant in the room. We talk about the two parties as they are so, so different from each other, and they are on policy perspectives, but the average Democrat and the average Republican are actually way closer together than the average Democratic politician and Republican politician, right? And so we complete these two ideas, and so then it's like, oh, well, this isn't mine, right? Like, we forget how much we have in common with each other. And so then that also spills out into this news media coverage, and we don't trust it. We don't like it. We think they're pushing a view, and it's not for me. And so it's this line sort of between news and advocacy, right? And I think that becomes hard, right? Because even news organizations that feel like they are just news organizations then get accused of being advocates. And then there are some places that are advocates, or not even advocates, just straight up opinion, but people treat them like news. And so that hurts people's understanding of what the news environment is, and ultimately just sort of tarnishes the whole thing. I don't think it's dead. Obviously, I think it's something that can be recovered from, but it's going to take some work.
Well, we know that Congress and multiple parts of the federal government and different administrations have historically very low ratings. Do you think part of that, because the national media is forced to cover that drags them down? Or is it more so how they go about it that ends up dragging them down?
A little bit of both. So when you look at ratings of things like government and politicians, very, very consistently, we always see that Congress sucks, but my congressperson is great,
yeah.
Right? And you get that with news too. News sucks, but I like my local news the best, right? So of all of the different platforms of news, no matter how you want to slice it, the thing that still has the most trust consistently is local news, that we trust the people that we know, that we have connections with more. So as local news declines, because that is something that's definitely happening, right? News deserts are huge. There's less local news for people to trust. So there's less of, oh, my congressperson is great. Like, I don't have my local channel that I can say is great. And so I think that spreads. But also it's just like we're covering vitriol and we're having to compete with everything else that exists. And so if everyone else is rage bait and that's what's getting clicks and that's what's driving advertising dollars, well, do you need to play that game too to also get clicks and also get advertising dollars and continue to survive? And so it's both, I think, ultimately play into that.
As you've spoken about the various projects and obviously topics that you're covering, what are some of the major obstacles to conducting this kind of research?
The biggest obstacle is to getting people to participate, right? Because wow. I use people. I want regular people to participate with me. And so to do that, I pay people, right? Not a ton, but you pay them to participate. But you still have to initially agree to participate, right? And so I'm primarily a survey and experimental researcher, right? Which means that I care a lot about who participates, right? Okay. I either want it with a survey that it needs to be, you know, a representative group of people. So I need to make sure if I'm making claims like social media isn't horrible for society, I need to make sure that I have all of society represented in my sample. And so if I can't get those people into my sample because they don't want to participate, right, then that's harmful, right? And yeah. So a lot of sort of the polling research that you see, that's something that we're dealing with constantly. How can we encourage and make sure that everyone participates? If I'm asking you to do an experiment, how can I ensure that you're actually paying attention, that you're reading that story that talks about how Democrats and Republicans are similar? And if that, you know, reduces sort of the polarization, I need people to participate. Do survey. Survey karma is a thing. I don't know. I believe in it.
We've talked a lot about your work studying and researching political communications, but you're also the chair of the public relations department here at UF. What's the overlap for you between these two fields?
Being chair is not a job that I expected to do at all. I do enjoy it because I have a fabulous department, right? So I say my job as professor is very me focused, right? I get to decide what I'm curious about and I go answer that question. Being department chair is 0% about me, right? Being department chair, it is my job to make everyone else who touches my department better. It is my job to make sure that I am developing and encouraging a curriculum that gets my students jobs. It is my job to ensure that all of my faculty members want to stay at University of Florida, that they aren't me at WSU looking for my next spot. I need to make sure that I'm creating the culture and the environment that faculty want to stay in. So it's my job to remove their roadblocks, right? So I spend a ridiculous amount of time on email and dealing with issues and in meetings and stuff like that.
Self-governance committees.
Right. All of the committees, all of that sort of stuff, right? So it's a very different job. Again, my husband's a professor. Some days we, as we're driving home, talk about what I did for the day. And he's like, that sounds like a waste of a PhD. I'm like, yes, it is. But so I talked to, again, because I didn't intend to go into administration at all. I talked to a lot of people who I respect before I agreed to do the position. And what they talked about is they're like, yes, it is going to be a waste of a PhD for you. However, what you do should elevate everyone else in that department. So it is sort of the ultimate service role. And I have been good about able to carve out some of my time. So I'm still doing research, right? Because again, I told you, that's my line in the sand. You tell me I get to do no more research projects, I'm out. But it is a very, very different job. It's all of the things behind the scenes, all of the putting out fires and dealing with the weirdest emails that you would ever see. So
I guess the next question that comes from that, with your line in the sand of all wanting to do research, is where is your research taking you next? Is there a project that you're excited about and that you're wanting people to do the surveys for?
and tell us where we sign the NDA.
Exactly. always. So what I'm looking at right now is really podcasting and some of these other alternative forms of media. So trying to understand where we're going next with communication in these alternative formats. So we know people are fragmenting, but okay, so what does that look like? What do what we would call these sort of hyper-partisan sites? What is sort of the future of podcasting? Who's listening to podcasts? What type of podcasts are they listening to? How are they listening to them? So are they still paying sort of the same attention to a podcast as they would if they were reading something? Me? I do. I'm one of those like very strange people. I acknowledge my inability to multitask. So I can only like listen to a podcast if I'm like on the bus or something like that. Or I'm literally just sitting there like listening. Because otherwise I start cooking, I'm doing something else, and I've lost it. But so that's what sort of a series of projects are that I'm doing right now, is to try to understand how that's shaping and how that's influencing anti-democratic attitudes and participation and things like that. Again, with the goal of trying to understand, if we understand maybe what's eroding democracy, then we can try to correct it or try to fix it, try to encourage people to do things in ways that are better for democracy.
That's awesome.
So what courses do you currently teach here at the CJC?
So I teach less now as chair, but I do still teach political communication occasionally. I'm teaching it right now. It's part of the certificate that you can get, a joint between PoliSci, MPMT, and the PR department. I also still teach research methods sometimes, which is super fun. Again, it's the best. PUR 3500, you see Hutchins on there, you come take it with me. It's a good time. I also teach crisis comm. I teach grad polcom. But I'm spending more time doing internships and independent study credits and things like that, and more of sort of the running of the department. So I have more student interaction now as chair than I did as a regular professor, but it's less in like the traditional classroom space. But I'm still there. Come find me. We have good times.
And finally, what advice do you have for those who want to maybe know that they are doing a better job at qualifying their sources that they're reading and interacting with, such as on social media?
If you like everything you're reading, you're doing it wrong.
Uh-oh.
Right? Like, make sure that you're exposing yourself to a variety of views is really the biggest thing. Like, find somebody that you think you totally disagree with and hate read them. I don't care if you're like hate reading them, but read them. Be exposed to understanding why someone different from you thinks the way they do.
And then put the feedback in the comment section.
Oh, please don't. And also don't read comment sections. I've done research on comment sections. And so like I get a new RA and I'm like, oh, we need like mean comments for this experiment. Like, please go to these sites and like scroll them. And they're like, Maya, you have destroyed my faith in humanity. Stay out of the comment section.
You can't pick up the sarcasm that's involved on
right?
the comment section.
It's where people like get their hate out. I don't know.
It's also where people just like crash out
right?
on every view.
But really, like, read something that you don't like. Yeah. Make sure that you're getting all of that. If you're like super excited, if something makes you too happy when you're reading it, fact check that, right? Like, is that true? The truth always lies in the middle, vast, vast majority of the time, right? And so if you're consuming a lot, you'll ultimately find what it is. If you see something that it's like, oh, this is great, but no one else is reporting it, probably not a real thing, right? But read more. Variety.
Excellent.
I think my question is for a student that is looking to get engaged in research, maybe political research or other research, how can they get in contact with you, and who could be a great resource or a resource on campus that they can reach out to?
Any faculty member that does research is going to be so excited to have an undergrad come up to them and be like, hey, I saw you do research on whatever. Could I like come and sit in on your research meetings or learn a little bit more about what you do? They are going to be so excited. If you don't know what they do, so like when a student comes up to me and they're like, I want to know about public relations research. That's not what I do, right? Like, I do research that I think is relevant to the field of public relations, but I am a political researcher. So like, read their bio and you're like, ooh, that sounds exciting. Go talk to them. They will be so excited to like bring you in.
Well, Maya, thank you for joining us today. We had a great time, and by all means, take her class. You get a lot out of it.
There we go. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Communicator Podcast is a production of U.S. College of Journalism and Communications. This episode is produced by Riley Fowler and Patrice Coton. Thanks to our guest, Maya Hutchins, hosted by Matthew Abramson and featuring Riley Fowler and Patrice Coton. Special thanks to WUFT. Go Gators!